Hey folks, you're listening to a special 9-part series on gender, gender politics, and gender equality. Obviously, you can do what you'd like in terms of how you listen to them, but I've designed these to be listened to in order. Each episode builds on the last one in a logical way. Think of it like you'd think of a book. If you take things out of order, a lot of it is going to be hard to understand or just seem off. So if you've just stumbled into this episode, please go back to the start. Otherwise, thanks for listening to everything in order. Let's get into it. Okay, so I might retitle it, but at the moment my working title for this episode is If the World of Sexuality is Built Around Men, Why Are They So Bad at It? So obviously I'm sort of responding there to two ideas that I think are floating around the mainstream, which is that the world of sex is built around men, or the world is built around male sexuality, and also there's a fair bit of complaint around what men are like at sex. So I guess the way I'd like to tackle this is first to sort of agree or like look into the truth of that, of how it is built around men, and how it's, shall we say, shit for women. But then I'd like to flip and explore ways that that's not true, or it's the other way around. I'd like to look at that on a few levels. And I think that that'll draw us to a conclusion that sort of makes a bit of sense around some of the male behaviours we see. And then, as always, look towards some solutions. Let's start with how it is built around men. There's lots of ways, but some that came to mind for me is that for a long time, male bodies were more anatomically studied than female bodies. So there was a sort of an education advantage. I don't know to what extent that was interest versus the bodies that happened to be available and the ethics of the time, I'm not sure. Because I know cadavers and sometimes experiments on male conscripts influence that stuff, but I don't know exactly where the line lies. Western medicine definitely used to be the almost exclusive domain of men. In fact, it's probably true to say it was the exclusive domain of men. And either they were more interested in male sexuality and didn't value female sexuality, or perhaps they were more comfortable exploring their own bodies and male bodies than given the taboos around exploring female bodies. I'm not sure. But either way, male sexuality was more studied.
Well, especially if ankles were risque, well, that left a lot to be, discovered, didn't it?
It would have been hard to run experiments on female bodies when even ankles were too taboo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think also a way that the world of sexuality is built around men, and more specifically bad male sexual behaviour, is there's a sort of a, of course he's oversexed, he's male attitude. You know, what are you going to do? There's almost like a shrugging dismissal of like, you know, don't worry about it, just get on with life or something like that. It's his nature, and it can sort of sound like an acceptance of that, which ... over to he can get away with anything. And we also know that, like, the law is utterly inadequate at pursuing sexual assault. So if we look at this from the perspective of women receive more sexual assault, then, it feels like the whole legal patriarchal system is deliberately letting men off the hook. So I think that's one of the strong ways that encourage people to think that the world is built around male sexuality and male freedom to do what they want and get off scot-free. I don't know. Anything to add?
Yeah, from a history perspective, if you look at how sexual appetite is still portrayed from a historical perspective, for men, sexual appetite is nature, and how you should behave and, you know, you're virile, excellent. Women, it's a mental disease.
Which
So.
is really funny when you, I mean, it's really funny, full stop, but it's really funny when you think about the logic behind suggesting that, our evolution through nature has encouraged men to be oversexed. The same would apply to women. Like, if women are hornbags, then the species is more likely to reproduce. If men are hornbags, the species is more likely to reproduce.
But if women are property, that's not so much fun. So yeah, that's and it creates more problems to solve, because you then have more mouths to feed and it's a bigger financial burden and all of that kind of stuff as well. But yeah, it's just interesting that that's the difference from history. Yeah, and I don't, in some ways, I don't think that's shifted.
Yeah, I think that's still pretty mainstream thinking. It's still an incredible amount of debate that goes on around who's more sexual. All right, let's move on to ways that it's shit for women. I mean, we've sort of touched on that already. But yeah, as you were just saying, yeah, female sexual pleasure and even orgasms and squirting was doubted if any of those things were real. If they were real, they were shamed. Slut shaming. They were also feared. So, like, for instance, yeah, in the case of genital mutilation, I think that's an extraordinarily distressing expression of the fear and mistrust and desire to shut down and contain and control female sexuality. And I think I know people in the male rights camp talk about male circumcision as comparable. I've got to say, from where I sit, it doesn't feel like that. I'm circumcised and I don't love that fact. I wish I had choice in it, but that's different. Like having something ostensibly done for hygienic or possibly religious reasons, but that isn't so much specifically to shut down my sexuality, is very different from female genital mutilation.
Yeah, definitely. Look, the still function. A lot of this also comes back to men need to orgasm to procreate, women don't.
Yes.
Like at a fundamental basic level, women do not have to have an orgasm or have to feel pleasure at all for the act of procreation. Men do.
Although, like, it's beneficial if she does because she's going to be more available and more interested. But yes. And that little act, we're going to touch on that in a minute, but that little act of the fact that he has to orgasm, I think everyone gets ripped off by that. Because it's the most I mean, has anyone ever heard of premature ejaculation? And like, no one really particularly wins from that arrangement. I don't
No.
think. So still on the topic of how it's shit for women, arguably the ways that women are slut-shamed or at the other end of the spectrum called frigid may be more extreme than the way we talk about men. I mean, men might be accused of being womanizers or chasing skirt or whatever, but it feels to me like that is more severe against women. This one was making me screamingly mad about 6 months ago, when I discovered about how menstruation is regarded by various religions. So I want to name Hinduism, Orthodox Judaism, and Islam. Also, arguably, in general culture, I think a lot of people have got a certain degree of ick with regards to bleeding vaginas.
Not allowed to talk about that at work.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank God we're not in the workplace. But yeah,
That's both
specifically.
from, sorry, go. And that's both from a when you are menstruating and the effect that might have on you, your body and or your mind, but that's also when you happen to enter the stop period of that and it wreaks complete havoc on your life. Or it can. And you still have to show up at work like nothing is different, and we're starting to see that shift. But that's, that and having to talk about that with partners, whether you want to or not, isn't the most fun. So yeah, that's also how it shows up. So yeah.
Circling back to the religion bit, like the thought that Just bleeding means that you will violate the sanctity of a temple. For fuck's sake.
Yeah, that's been fun.
Listeners have probably worked out that I'm not very religious. Sorry, Emma.
Oh yeah, just the fun of exclusion because of a bodily function. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
And also back to your, do we think that women get a worse gig of the slut shaming? And it's hard to tell whether it's sort of religious and or just slut shaming, but the combination of you're allowed to stone a woman to death or do what are they, an honor killing if they've had sex outside of a man's decree. That's pretty shit.
Yeah, that's pretty shit. What's also pretty shit is that rape is a feature of war, a weapon of war. What's also pretty shit is that rape is a feature of peacetime.
Exactly.
I mean, everyone gets raped, but I think we would generally agree that that one is tilted more disadvantageously against you as a
Yeah.
woman. And on that note, you're almost all women have experienced sexual assault of some description. I think you could probably change that to all of a certain age, but anyway, seeking justice for that sexual assault is often worse than the original incident. You get stuck with the complicated plumbing,
Oh my God, it's so complicated.
and you have to have a freaking thing grow in you. If that's your choice.
Yeah, that external incubator could be a really handy thing.
Well, that's how I think of you.
No, I got those parts removed. It's fine.
Oh, damn. Inadequate in relation to that plumbing disadvantage. There's also definitely a plumbing advantage there, but in relation to the disadvantage of that, also inadequate access and choice around education in relation to all of that stuff, birth control, abortions.
I'm getting worse.
Perhaps. Anything to add? Anything I miss about how it's shit for women or how it's built around men? I mean, I'm sure there's tons. And these are just like ideas off the top of my head. This is not meant to be a comprehensive list. We're just sort of setting some context.
Sounds pretty shit so far.
Yep. Okay. All right. Well, let's look at ways that it is not actually built around male sexuality, because even though it's in some ways it is, and in many ways it's shit for women, that doesn't automatically mean that it's great for men. And I want to break this into a couple of subheadings, which I'll call a numbers game, social pressures, education, knowledge, and choice, and sort of hatred and mistrust of male sexuality. So, under that first topic of a numbers game, this is just some random numbers. Sex work is a really interesting data source in this, in that generally speaking, in the capitalist system, the one giving money for something is the one that wants something and has less value. So the sex worker is actually the valuable role in that exchange. It's
A fun way to think about that.
yeah, it is. If it was a man's world, then women would be paying men for sex. And that is sometimes the case, but it's about 3 or 4 or 5% compared to men paying for sex from women. For heterosexual folks, the tables in this kind of the dating game, I guess, the tables are very tilted. So more women are either bi or lesbian, but more women are bi and are in relationships or sexual situations with other women. So there's just a numbers availability tilt in the dating field. And you can see that in dating apps and dating sites. And some of them are absolutely ridiculously tilted. Like the Ashley Madison website is a not fair example because arguably it was more tilted towards a particular type of male fantasy. So this is the data I'm about to give is extreme. But when they had a massive data privacy breach and people analysed their data, they found that 90% of people on the site were male. So it's not like a sort of a 45, 55% kind of a difference. It's 90 to 10. And of the 10% that were allegedly female, more than half of them were bots. And this was about 10 years ago before bots were even a thing. So if you imagine the experience of being a male person on that site, your chances of winding up with success versus frustration are not good. So still on the dot point of the tables being tilted in terms of numbers in the dating game. Sexuality events are much harder and much more expensive to get into as a male. So there's a great example at one of our local sexuality venues where single female tickets are $35 and male tickets are $350 if you can get them. So that's like a really good way of way we were talking about the open market forces back in the wage gap. This is a really good example of how the open market responds the other way around. So as a consequence in the dating game, men have to try a lot harder and take a lot more risks, which really isn't good for anyone because only the most assertive, aggressive alphas get through that system, and women understandably feel a bit pounced upon. But I would generally suggest that being the gatekeeper, like being overwhelmed by incoming responses, is a better problem to have than having to spend hundreds of requests.
Well, if you're on a dating site, that's probably why you're there, is to get some sort of input.
Yes. And even outside of the dating realm, most of us desire to have some level of relationship in our life, and it's a little easier when you're slightly overwhelmed for options rather than desperate.
Yes.
All these things also mean that in the sexuality space, male type people have on average less opportunities to learn and practice and just like mingle and have relationships. They are actually less skilled on average because of this tilt in the numbers. I saw this also in, so I've run sexuality workshops of quite a variety of things over the last sort of 12 or 14 years. This again is an extreme example, but in a mixed gender situation where people had the opportunity to nominate who they would like to be paired with, the women type people were in the top 50%, and the male type people were in the bottom 50%, and there was no intermingling, like there was no grey zone in the middle where it was a bit of this and a bit of that. Most of the time, it's not been that extreme, but that trend has always been there. Women are much more desirable in the dating game. Yeah, so that's my thoughts on some just some random numbers. I was going to move on to social pressures, unless you've got any thoughts or questions.
I was just going to quickly add, and you can pull it out if needs be, but when I ran a workshop recently, it was talking partially about interacting and how that is going to happen, like interacting intimately, and noting that unless one knows oneself, it's really harder for people to want to play with you intimately because that you're not as safe. And if we circle right back to, I think, the first episode that we did, where we were talking about the things that females are socially structured to do, like learning about our feelings, learning about how to interact with each other and where our edges are, all those things which are just socially built into our structures more than they are into males, by broadly speaking, then that's going to make us that more desirable partner, the more desirable person to play with, to get into involved with, because if we know, if anyone, any human at all, knows themselves better, they're safer for other people to be around. And so those of us who know ourselves better, which in general, because of our socialization is females, obviously with heaps of wonderful exceptions, then that's, yeah, it's not surprising that those numbers are stacked that way.
Yeah, I love it. So if this was a car repair competition, those of us that have been socialized male are going to have probably an advantage in that space, just thanks through to the skills that we've been socialized and inherited. But the dating game is around self-development, communication skills, relationship skills, touch skills, and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, they're all advantage women. I've got great news. If you've made it this far through the series, there's obviously something about it that's striking a chord for you or is interesting in some way, even if you're disagreeing with parts of it. I know from people I've been speaking to that many folks are inspired to the point where you're wanting to get involved on some level, and this is where the great news comes in. Getting involved, or even just contributing and helping out, is really easy. All you've got to do is hit the share button, and half a minute later, you'll have done your bit. When it comes to the gender equality movements, all of us have spoken about parts of it with others in the past, sometimes with much passion. All of us know someone who's been thinking about this stuff but has struggled to find the language or the permission or whatever to take their thinking further. Many of us know people who are struggling with some aspect of the topics we've been discussing. These are the people you might want to share an episode with. And, just like that, you've done something for me, something for the person you shared with, and something for the world. Good job you for getting all pan-political and stuff.
So you're leading us beautifully into social pressures. So I want to add to that and say not being able to admit that you need help, so classic male challenge, really does not make you a great bed partner. it's not a great way to go through your sex life with this assumption that somehow you're meant to know what you're meant to be doing and you can't ask for help or admit that you're not confident. And I think even like you see this a lot when you look at lists of like what women are looking for in a man, they always say confidence. And so there, yeah, there's that pressure. Next point is men are socialized to assess their worth based on the quantity of sex they're having, which tends to create an incredible amount of pressure and also less freedom to go with the flow. So as we know, men can come across as a little bit pressureful when it comes to sex. Next up point, men often do more of the instigating and more of the topping, and that is just naturally higher risk territory. So just based on that alone, it's going to be much easier to find examples of dudes fucking things up, because if you're the one doing the instigating and the topping, you're going to fuck up. And it's actually, this is just purely anecdotal. We're deeply into Roger's anecdotal story territory here. it's touching. It's weird when... people that identify as women around me are going out on their first sexual date with another person that identifies as a woman. Just watching the nervousness and the anxiety and the fear of, oh my God, how is anyone meant to work that stuff out? And what if I fuck it up? And what if I come across as a perpetrator? And I've just witnessed this so many times, and there's a part of me going, there's something really validating about this, because it really adds visibility over the fear and anxiety I have in the dating game, if in a hetero context. Yeah. Anyway, next dot point, still under the topic of social pressures. When you're playing in that system, because we have at the moment, thank God, in some ways, thank God, we have a heightened awareness around bad male behavior, and we're a long way down the path of articulating that. When you're moving through that world, dating or sexuality, as a man, everything you do can be described or perceived as negative, no matter what your intentions. There is no act you can do in that space that is free from being regarded as suspicious. And that is not arousing. And that does not make you a calm person.
No, that's the whole, if you're looking for circles, you'll find circles.
Yeah. 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 I think also... this concept that men are into the idea of getting away with what they can get away with, which I think in some ways does describe the mainstream approach to sexuality at the moment. There is a bit of a sense of what you can get away with. But it's not actually a good environment, because if you take that thought to the extreme and you rape someone, you have to live with yourself. And on some level, you know that you're a fucking asshole. And there's no amount of justifying and no amount of a religion or a culture that is behind you to let you off the hook from that. And if you dial back from that extreme situation, if you know on some level that you've been pushing or nagging for something, or just on a really subtle level, overlooked your own or someone else's subtle signals of consent, you got to live with yourself. And it's actually not possible to have self-pride and self-worth and also hold on to that thought. So that thing around the idea that men can get away with stuff, that is not an indicator that things are going well.
Just like to add there, though, that there seems to be quite a lot of religious backup for some of that shit.
Yeah.
Because you were just saying there's no amount of religious thing that'll let you live happily with that. But
yeah,
I'm not sure that's totally true. But aside from that, I get your point and I agree with your point. I just think that, unfortunately, there are people who go, yep, this is okay. In fact, it's religiously sanctified that I've just stoned this woman to death. Like raped her because she deserved it, etc. I think actually some people have convinced themselves that that's okay.
Yeah.
And pretty pukeful, but and luckily we're not in that situation mostly. So in general, I am totally agreeing with what you're saying. I just think sadly that that's not always the case.
I think all will exist. So I think you are right. That person, that character, that spirit does exist. Mm-hmm. We are beasts. I think also on some level, like I wonder how many people that have committed acts like that on some level know exactly what they've done.
Oh, yeah.
And
utterly hate themselves.
Yes. Kevin Spacey said in that film, every being in the universe knows right from wrong, and laws and everything else is just irrelevant. So I don't know where the line is. I don't know whatever. I do know at the other end of the spectrum, like we spoke before about rape is a weapon of war.
Mm.
We sometimes portray marauding mobs of male armies as people that just rape and pillage every town that they go through. Again, I don't know where the line is, but some men do that, and some men definitely do not do that and will outright refuse and just want no part in that entire system and come back completely traumatized. So I don't know where the line is, but it is not as simple as saying that all men do that.
Thankfully, no.
No, it's a symptom of something broken.
Yeah.
Be it people who end up in those situations. There's very few people who actually seek that out as, yes, this is my pinnacle of being. There are a lot of people who are pushed into circumstances to do things that, you know, would not necessarily be their nature because they don't have any other choice. And whether they do or not, they don't see that they have another choice. So if you're a person, and we're talking about men. So if you're a man who can't have sexual relations with somebody that they want to have sexual relations with consensually, and the alternative is nothing, sometimes they're backed into a corner enough that that's the alternative. So, you know, what we're actually talking about here is a very broken place where this is the solution for some people. Yeah. And no, it might not sit well, but the alternative is nothing.
Yeah.
And it's that's not okay either, right?
Oh, God. It's really funny. Listening to you speak, I find myself thinking about shame and pride. And shame is really appropriate for these types of behavior. And as you're talking about that, I'm also talking about opportunists. And I think that exists of men who just go, well, the opportunity was there. She was passed out, .. And obviously, we want to respond to that with a degree of shame, cultural shame, saying that is not okay. But ironically, I think that that sort of behavior is only possible when you have a lack of self-worth and a lack of pride. So I think often, yeah, and it sounds counterintuitive to say what we need here is more male pride. But, I think we do.
A genuine pride, not ego.
Genuine pride.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's male pride. I think it's pride in being a person and pride in how you show up in the world and relate and connect. Yeah.
Pride in good conduct.
Yeah.
And doing something good for the world, yeah. Yeah, as opposed to proud boys.
Wow, these are some pretty heavy topics we're doing at the moment. I promise we'll pull out of this territory soon. But unfortunately, it gets worse before it gets better. Specifically, I want to pick up on Emma's comment about the stoning of adulterous women and then address another 3 points that have come up over the last sort of 5 minutes of content that I think need clarifying.
So yeah, this does get kind of gruesome. If you want to fast forward, if you're not into listening to the details about capital punishment, you might want to fast forward about three and a half minutes, something like that. And yeah, like I debated the utility or worth of putting this content in, but I think there's a utility to knowing what's actually going on. And I also think in a kind of a maybe counterintuitive way, I think it's actually disrespectful to victims to regard what happens to them as being unspeakable. Yeah. With that said, this is definitely not my area of expertise. All I've done, like as you know, with this whole podcast series, to the extent that there's a usefulness in what I'm discussing here, what we're discussing here, it's almost entirely limited to the Australian context, or at least, you know, first economies context. So yeah, this is really well outside my area of expertise, and all I've done is a couple of hours of research to fact check a couple of things. So what we're talking about here is Sharia law, which is a section of Muslim culture, and specifically the parts regarding the stoning of women for adulterous behavior, is more from some scriptures built around the Quran rather than the Quran itself. I also understand that capital punishment, and this form of capital punishment in particular, is really heavily disputed internally within Muslim culture, and it's also extremely rare. And while obviously any amount of this, in my opinion, any amount of this type of behavior or punishment or whatever is wildly wrong, even when you factor in underreporting over the last, you know, reasonable period of time, it looks like we're talking about quantities in the tens, unlikely to be up as high as the hundreds, but yeah, hard to know. So yes, the situation is that various forms of capital punishment occur, and this includes stoning. And I'd always just assumed that a person was buried with their head above the surface and that they were stoned by people throwing stones. It looks like the generally, it's weird to say the word acceptable in this context, but the acceptable way to carry out this punishment is by dumping a load of rocks onto someone. So I guess at least that's quicker and more humane. Under the banner of capital punishment, and again, we're still referring to Muslim cultures and Sharia law in particular, as I understand it, we're also looking at beheadings, amputations, and various other things, which I don't think have a place here. Overall, if you look at the totality of the statistics with the little big asterisks, you know, as best we have statistics and can rely on them, it looks like more capital punishment happens to men than women, or quite a lot more. And it also includes stoning. So men are stoned as well as women, and actually men are more likely, like a higher number of, it's only a marginal figure, but more men are stoned to death than women. However, there is very much a, or I don't know about very much, but there's a difference in the gendered nature of things. So it is the case that women are more likely to be stoned to death for adultery. Men are more likely to be stoned to death and various other forms of capital punishment for other crimes. This whole scene is just such a mess, and I am so, so sorry to everyone that has any involvement in any of this. What a mess. Yeah, at times like this, I'm reminded that we're really not that far advanced from where we were a million years ago and where sort of, chimps and monkeys are now. And I'm also reminded and extremely grateful that I live in an extremely liberal culture. So anyway, that's the gruesome stuff done, although we still are in heavy territory for a little longer. And yeah, just another reminder with the above, definitely not my area of expertise. If this is a topic that's of interest to you, yeah, do your own research and see what you come up with. But yeah, circling back to the content to respond to a few points, Emma was saying something along the lines that for people that are committing bad behavior and rape, that they can soothe themselves or convince themselves that religion makes it okay. Yeah, and I just want to, I sort of responded a bit when we were recording, but I mostly just wanted to say, for some people, that is going to be true. I think for a certain amount of other people, even if they've got a religion, or if you look back at war crimes, that a government or whatever else telling them that it's okay, and even if in the moment people tell themselves that the crimes they're committing are okay, I think on some level most people still know, and except perhaps for a small percentage of sociopaths and psychopaths, I think that people's guilt and conscience does tend to eat away at them over time. That's no satisfaction to the victim, but yeah, I think that mechanism is there. The second point I was going to make, yeah, soon after that one was around, well, I'll just say it as it is, when in warlike situation and where rape is being used as a weapon, I don't know what percentage, this is impossible to measure, but a substantial percentage of men refuse to have any participation in things like that. And also, this is kind of getting anecdotal as much as anything else, but I know that like we're very familiar that a lot of soldiers come back from war with what we now understand to be PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah, a lot of that is from men that have, or soldiers rather, who have witnessed things or that know what was going on, even if they weren't directly involved. So I guess in this context, this is what a good person, a person of moral fortitude, looks like. And then the third point I wanted to make was one of Inga's comments. I mean, and probably none of you as listeners heard it this way, but there's a small chance you could have heard that as Inga saying that it's okay to behave badly and potentially rape if you are desperate and have no other options. Just out of an abundance of caution, I just wanted to clarify, there is absolutely no chance in the world that this is Inga's position. I'm guessing it's probably true that's a justification that does go on in the minds of some rapists. There's no chance Inga was saying that that's acceptable. I think more relevant to this conversation, perhaps, is that I reckon there is a bit of a sort of a justification that goes on in the minds of people who are risk-taking in other ways. So being overly active pursuers, maybe not inclined to take no as an answer or not wanting to hear that as an answer, maybe people that are making repetitive offers, unsolicited dick pics and those sorts of behaviors. Maybe there is a bit of a logical process or a bit of a justification that goes on in the minds of those folks of being like, well, I've got no options, so I might as well take some risks. Yeah, I think that comes into play a little bit, but yeah, obviously no one's saying that any of that's okay. So yeah, we've sort of already covered this point around when you're male, almost everything you do can be seen as problematic, whereas when you are female, it's almost impossible to be seen as the perpetrator. I've seen this a lot as someone that's run sexuality events, and I've often sat around with my co-hosts and looked at certain activities and said, what would this look like if we flipped the genders? And often it's very disturbing. It's like absolutely invisible when something's going on, when she's topping, but when he's topping, it's like, oh, that does not feel right. And although I think that at least historically and definitely still now, the slut and sleaze shaming against women has been awful, I think it's now perhaps even more awful around the male side. I don't know. It's impossible to compare. But I know that, like, sleazebag, womanizer, just the thought that he's an oversexed, crazy lunatic, will accept anything that he's given, is desperate for it. None of that feels like compliments.
It's not.
Mm. I don't know how to compare one for one, and maybe I shouldn't have framed it that way. I don't want to compare. Let's not go down that path. Let me just say it doesn't feel like it's a world of abundant flowers and sexuality.
Oh,
Sorry,
go
am I
back
going? Oh,
there.
okay. So what I'm seeing is there is a there men are still shamed for their sexuality. It might look different than how women are shamed for their sexuality. And their eagerness, but they're still shamed for their sexuality and wanting this thing. It might just look different, but at its core, it's still a similar kind of thing.
At the schools where I am, and again, I only have a tiny little window, but there's hundreds of kids at each, and I've been to probably 30, between 30 and 50 schools in the last couple of years, and the slut shaming for women, girls, is massive. Massive, massive, massive. And the yay, good on you, you've got another notch in your belt is also quite strong for the boys. It's, as we know, I'm in the sort of lower socioeconomic schools. But it's huge. Actually, I'm at least once a week, if not, and sometimes many times in a week, saying, no, we're not slut shaming in here. And talking to them at length about slut shaming and how it's based on fear and all these, like every single week, there's slut shaming happening in the classrooms. And it'll happen sometimes as jokes and majority just as horrible comments, like, oh, I won't say the things, but anyway, yeah, it is still actually quite rife in
Yeah, I
the
don't doubt that
school.
for a second. Yeah.
And all against the women, not against them. No way. Maybe once or twice I've heard it saying, oh, he's a slut. But more than it's sort of like, it's said with a bit of a snigger and a like, oh, let's pull him down. But also, God, that's pretty cool towards him. Never cool towards her.
A lot of this is
See
going
that?
to be.
Sorry, Rog. I see the shift in the 40s. So once you hit your 40s, if you're a man who's sleeping around a lot, you're like, oh, he's having a midlife crisis. Don't you think he should grow up a bit? And whereas, oh no, all power to you. You found your sexuality. You're exploring yourself when it comes to women. So I see it absolutely flip once we get older.
A lot of this is going to depend on what bubble we're in, because
Yeah,
I am
valid.
definitely not a student at your school, Emma.
Thank God.
And from what little I know about it, it sounds like it's a particular slice. But I know in my world of the sex positive community was never set up for me. So it depends on bubbles. So yeah, I don't know how to compare one for the other, but suffice to say, both dynamics are there for all of us. Yeah. So we're still on social pressures. When you make a mistake or are perceived to have made a mistake, you will not win in a he said, she said situation. And the price you will pay for that will be your social credit. You will also be regarded as entitled for wanting sex. So when, say, like for instance, even sitting here talking about this difference in the dating numbers, I've been accused of being entitled for talking about that stuff. And it's fascinating when you compare that to how we talk about, say, when curvy women say, I want a right to my sexuality, or when older women say, I want a right to my sexuality. We don't say, well, you're an entitled bitch. But I kind of get that feedback a fair bit. Clarification, I think I might have misspoken there. I don't get that feedback a fair bit. I meant to say I hear that feedback in the world around me a fair bit. So when men, and the extreme example of this would be incels, speak up about, let's say, their right to explore and experience their sexuality, they're likely to be leveled with an accusation of that they are being entitled. But when we look at other groups who we might be more favorably disposed to, and I give the example of curvy women or older women, when they speak up for their desire, the same desire to pursue the same things, we don't dismiss them as being entitled. So I see that in the world around me a lot. I didn't mean to refer to myself. And lastly here, maybe there's, I don't think this is the whole story, the whole truth by a long way, but it's possible that female partners are more likely to be compared based on how pleasure-centric they can be towards themselves, and male partners are more likely to be compared based on how much they can pleasure their women.
That's all interesting. Compared by who? And I just lost the track there a bit, but it sounded interesting.
It's complicated for a whole lot of reasons. This might be the case, but you can imagine you might hear a comment like, "Oh, like, did you make her come?" But mm-hmm. You won't hear that comment the other way around.
All right, unless you're in my circles, I get it. I'm like, I often talk about how. Anyway,
yeah. So I really agree with you that that point's a real grey one. And I don't know that I can support it beyond it being an idea that may or may not be supported. All right. So next subcategory here is around, so we're in the broad topic of how the world is not so much built around male sexuality. And this subtopic is around knowledge and education and choice. So I think men have less access to sex and relationship information, especially in a way that's sort of positive and useful for them. And we spoke about this a lot in an earlier episode. His education is more likely to be about how not to be a rapist, like a sort of working from the assumption that he's a bad person, like a wild animal waiting to break out. And her education is more likely to be around her needs and her pleasure and her rights. His education is more likely to be around what not to do rather than what to do, although all sex education is rubbish. I'm definitely not saying that female sex education is a tick and that's all there is to it. As we explored in gender separate spaces, so I won't go into it a lot here, but a lot of education and culture and conversation happens in spaces that men can't get into or in ways that are not welcoming. And it can be hard as a result of that, as a woman that's been exposed to more education, to sort of understand why men just don't get it. I think there's an assumption that if he ejaculates, that he's had a good time. And yeah, as a joke before, I think, frankly, I think male ejaculation and the male orgasm system rips us all off. Because if you're the owner of a dick, you spend about, I don't know, 60% of your time trying to be hard enough, 60% of your time trying not to come too soon, and the other 20% is like trying to pretend that you're having a good time. It's a hell of a lot of anxiety and a lot to manage and a lot to think about. And it's another reason also why I think men wind up topping a lot, is because you've got more agency and control over those systems when you're topping. But I think everyone gets ripped off by it. Like, I'm not under any illusion that quick early orgasms is a great outcome. It's complicated territory. The plumbing works against us in this way.
The only time it's worked to my benefit is when I don't really want to play anymore. And right. So I do that as quick and as fast as I can for them.
Yeah.
Then there's a natural stop point.
Yeah.
But even that's, you know, yeah. That's not for the good of everyone. That's not for the good of anyone.
No,
actually.
So I think we incompassionately talk about that and sort of say, oh, look at that. It's all built around his pleasure patterns. And I just don't think anyone's winning from that.
No. Nobody wins in that situation at all. No.
I think the the current movement for female pleasure and female education, which obviously I'm 100% in support of, it sort of frames itself often as catching up to where male sexuality is. Whereas in reality, I think we actually know way more these days about female pleasure than we do male sexuality. So it's hard, in some ways, it's hard to compare like for like here, but as some potential examples, almost everyone knows that multiple female orgasms are possible, but almost no one knows that multiple male orgasms are possible. Almost everyone knows of the clit, very few know of the frenulum. And almost everyone knows that G-spot orgasms are possible, and very few know about P-spot orgasms. Just a couple of little examples there that sort of make me wonder if it is in fact a question of female sexuality knowledge catching up with male sexuality knowledge. I think female sexuality knowledge might be way ahead.
I think we're all at the disadvantage of pleasure, and particularly pleasure from genitals, being demonized. I think if we could lose that, then and talk about it factually, and with interests, that would solve a few problems.
It would. And I wonder also again if like the bubble I move in is influencing my thinking there. So I'm in sex education, which is probably going to be vastly different to what's going on with the teens at your school, Emma.
Yeah, I was thinking I don't think most of them know anything. Maybe they know the word or the term G-spot. They wouldn't know much about it. They and rightly though, as you say, well, not rightly, sadly, they probably haven't heard the term P-spot. I would doubt most of them know, including the females, know where or what, know much about their clitoris.
At the same time, I don't think anyone would know about any of those male elements I spoke about.
Exactly.
So that's
Exactly.
just, low base.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
All right. And my last dot point on this topic of like less knowledge and education and choice is a really interesting one about sex work and the role that sex work plays in sex education. So, first, let me just be absolutely clear that I am not against sex work at all. I am very much in favour of sex work for all parties.
Misspoke again. I don't mean that everyone should see sex workers. I mean that both sides of the exchange, in terms of a worker and a client, I think that sex work can be potentially great for all parties in that context, meaning both parties of that exchange.
I think sex work can be a stunningly rewarding, empowering, positive thing for the sex worker. And I think that the sex worker exchange can be a positive, educational, rewarding, fulfilling exchange for the client. So that's the baseline I'm coming off. With that said, I do have some questions and concerns, and in my travels, I've seen some bad male patterns come out of experiences that happen in the sex work exchange. So, specifically, one of the things we like doing in this podcast series is criticizing capitalism. And capitalism and sex don't necessarily go well together. They can be coercive and manipulative, and because men, consciously or otherwise, see sex workers as sex educators because the vast majority of the time they are. Male clients take on some of those capitalist behaviours as normal, as best practice, and they don't even realise that they've taken on coercive and manipulative tactics. An example of that can be in the kink scene. We talk about don't renegotiate a scene from within a scene because we recognize that when someone is already altered, say for instance from a spanking, at that point in time, if you offer them oral sex, they'll probably say yes because they're halfway high just off natural endorphins. That's why we don't renegotiate a scene from within a scene if we're going to best practice, particularly with a new partner or something. However, in the sex work exchange, renegotiating a scene from within a scene is seen as good business practice. It's like getting more, getting extras out of a client when they're at a peak. there's also really confusing messages in there around what pleasure and interest look like, because and a lot of hostility, because as with any job, we sometimes work when we don't want to. And so in the context of a sexual exchange, that means we're sending signals of disinterest or frustration or regret. And we might also be faking orgasms. So a male client might be doing certain things and believing the fake orgasm, which is the ultimate confirmation that that activity is great. So they then take that activity and that style and that way of being, which is tolerable in a sex work exchange, and they try it in their dating life, and their partner looks back as if to say, what the hell are you doing? And he's going, why aren't you coming? So there's some really confusing education there. And I want to round that out and circle back and say, I'm talking about, I don't know, in the same way that a lot of the spectrums we've been talking about today, I don't know where the line is. I don't know what portion of sex work exchanges are net positive or net confusing, let's say. And I also want to round out by saying that I really do think that a huge portion of the world's sex education, sex research, and sex positivity comes from the sex work sector. So I'm massively positive. And I have also met plenty of workers who are doing the most stunning job of educating clients. So yeah, there's a whole mix of things there, and I don't know where the line is. Next subtopic is hatred and mistrust of male sexuality.
Just before we jump into that one, I was just in terms of when you were saying before about well, I've forgotten your words of equalizing in terms of women's pleasure. I was just thinking I was reading this vagina re-education book a while back, and I think maybe this concept of, you know, going back to finding a balance for women's physical pleasure is that the clitoris wasn't even known about, like it didn't exist according to anatomical books, etc., until I've forgotten whether it was the 70s or the 50s, or, you know, there was the bulk of time when it didn't exist. So it wasn't that we couldn't know about it, it just wasn't there. So that's possibly where this concept of rebalance is coming from, because of that, back to the anatomical stuff, and just not knowing enough about those things.
I really agree, and I really understand it. I guess the point I'm making is there has been an assumption that we already know everything there is to know about male anatomy and male sexuality, and that women are catching up. So the approximate parallel for the clit, and I do mean this in terms of some of the nerve endings that wind up in a female's clit, wind up in a male's frenulum. We didn't discover about the frenulum until really recently, and most people don't know how to approach that and its worth and role and importance as a focal point. So although it feels like we're catching up, actually knowledge of the clit means that you're way ahead.
Yay.
I did like what you were saying about sex work too. In a world where you could, for those of us in Australia, get a Medicare rebate for sex, a sex worker who was actually educating you on either your own body or a differently bodied person than you, or the same bodied person as you but not you, would be amazing. That would actually be really, really helpful. That's, you know, that is an instance where we could find more balance in that it's still, you know, and people are appropriately remunerated and it's appropriately valued.
Listeners may wish to go back about 20 or 30 episodes to an episode called something like Chats with a Porn Performer or something. I've forgotten the name of it. But we were chatting and she speaks about how when she first got into the sector, she just saw herself as someone earning money and as a performer. And it wasn't for years and years into it that she realized she was an educator and that what she was doing on screen was having a lot of influence. And it changed her behaviors. she started seeing herself in that role and playing more to it, as opposed to a lot of porn, particularly when I grew up. There's a huge difference between educational information and entertainment, and most porn is just what's framed to fit well on a small picture or a small screen. Vastly different, but a lot of people don't know the difference between what they're watching. I'm not anti-porn. I'm anti-education. I'm in favour of education, and in the absence of education, people lean on porn, which is not always helpful. Talking about episode 51 with Jessica Drake. Thoroughly recommend that listen. So yeah, hatred and mistrust of male sexuality. So we spoke about female circumcision, and I'm not saying that male castration is comparable. I'm not in a position to make that. But castration is clearly about male sexuality, and it does actually pop up quite a bit throughout history. I don't have numbers. I can't compare. I can't say which is worse, but they are more of a like-for-like comparison. As we said before, almost all women have experienced sexual assault. The reality is almost all men have also experienced sexual assault. Again, I'm not saying more or less. I'm not saying it's equal, and I'm not saying that the power dynamic of being assaulted by someone who may not be your physical superior is the same as when the tables are turned, but more on the murky relationship level, or if it's from an adult to a child or something like that. Yeah, the reality is most men have experienced sexual assault, whether they know it or not. I'm not saying it's the same, but it's not like 100% of women have experienced sexual assault and 0% of men. It's much more murky. Same difficulties around getting that prosecuted. Here's a fun one. If a woman exposes herself, she might wind up on the internet. If a man exposes himself, he might wind up in jail. I can't think of her name. I might have to drop this in later as an edit. There was, what's one of those? Not Paris Hilton. What's someone else that's adjacent to that from the same era? Anyway, she was out, a pop star. She was out in her Melbourne tour. It's been taken off the internet now, but she was just absolutely exposing herself all over. This was at the entertainment center or something. So, you know, 30,000 person gig. And she was just like legs akimbo, crotch asunder, absolutely exposing the entire audience. And it was regarded fabulously edgy, provocative, female power, gorgeous. And then the same week that that happened, a male footballer did a similar sort of move in a much more background kind of a way, and he went to jail.
Wow. Yep.
Doesn't seem very fair.
Some would say. And again, power dynamics and threat levels play into how these things are assessed. So it's not like for like, even though on some levels it is. But yeah, it's also not fair. One of the events I have run in my sex education business involves getting people to articulate the ways that they might feel unwelcome or invisible in the space. And every workshop, I've taught this workshop to a very large number of people. I'm talking somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 people just for this workshop. And every time it's taught in groups of about 30 people, there's about 3 or 4 people that will say male as one of the ways that they feel invisible or unwelcome. And I've never seen anyone write female. People talk about sometimes like, I feel like I'm going to get pounced upon. So you could say that that's female adjacent type of problems, and they are substantial and they're legitimate. but yeah, that's a really extreme difference. That's if you assume that like half the room, 3 or 4, so that's about 20 or 25% of men identify their gender as a way that makes them feel invisible or unwelcome. We tend to use women's bodies to sell products rather than men's. I think most people would feel sort of slightly assaulted if there was a half-naked man selling a product. Maybe not. Maybe there's more nuance there. But generally speaking, we use female bodies to sell products. And there's a whole other thing there around the pressure that that puts on women. But, yeah. And
sorry, just to that point.
Yep.
What that says is that women being sexual is something we'll pay money for. Which is, we talk about sex work, that's a lot of what is happening, but it's shown everywhere. But men being sexual, no, we're not going to pay money for that. We
No.
wouldn't do that. No.
No. And my last point here was actually, I think we've already covered it. I was just going to suggest we've got some annoying bodies and some annoying plumbing. I think we spoke about that, about how male ejaculation sort of robs everyone. Female anatomy, female plumbing. It's not as simple as this. I was going to say, can sort of like come all you want and be the center of attention all you want, but it's not that simple, so I don't want to say that.
No, but if we talk about men's bodies, what does happen though is everybody thinks they know how men's bodies work and how to turn on a person with a penis, when that's actually not the case. That they are as individual as everybody else, and what turns one person on doesn't necessarily turn another person on. And I've seen that play out with people I've been with, is there's an assumption that sex is done this way and that is pleasurable for a person with a penis, when in a lot of cases it's actually not. So that's some of the really negative ways, apart from, premature ejaculation and stuff. There's that assumption that we know how men's plumbing works, and we know how to handle that, and we don't have to try. We're just going to be good at that. So
And I think you could maybe go a step further also, which is to say that when dysfunction, in quotes, turns up, we treat it very differently. So dysfunction, which I think is just function, it's just a body and a psychology responding exactly as they should, and I think dysfunction is critical. So let's say function. When male function, when penis function looks either flaccid or premature ejaculative, we will regard that as his failing. However, when female anatomy turns up as either is not coming or is not wet or something like that, we're more likely to say, well, whoa, slow down. Maybe you need to think about how you're touching that. All right. So they are all the way, or some ways I could think of to sort of articulate that actually, no, I don't think it's quite as simple as saying that the world is built around male sexuality. I think the situation is a fair bit more nuanced than that. I was going to go into a bit of a live immersion experience and then pull out of this with a summary and a where to from here. Did we have any more thoughts or comments on any of that stuff we've just been dot pointing?
No, but I'm going to giggle every time you say thrust or pull out.
We'll pull out exactly. I got the note.
Love this subject material.
I was just thinking, and I don't know about, anyway, just with some of these thoughts of the whole, how am I going to word it? Like, just if a woman or female body will just lie there, and a male could sex her, like get on and go hump, 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 yay, I'm great, and leave. I think that's possibly where some of the chaos has come in terms of going, it is so much more likely that a male could enjoy that type of environment. A male could enjoy drunk sex. Like, if a female is drunk or passed out, the male is much more likely to still be able to go, yay, there's a warm hole there, that's fun, as compared to a female not being able to work, even just logistically, hydraulically, in terms of a drunk, passed out male would not likely have a hard enough penis to play with very successfully, etc. So, like, there's just a few weird kind of dynamics that make it much more seemingly like a male can enjoy sex that is far, far less enjoyable for a female in general. Like, obviously, that's when we're getting down to really basic and unbeautiful things a lot of the time, but I don't know.
I really agree with what you're saying, and I really like how that articulates where that sense that it looks and in some ways is built around his pleasure, at least like he can get away with that quality of stuff. or that type of thing.
Yeah, which is clearly not satisfying. You know, it's a very poor white bread version of life,
Yeah. Yeah,
but
it's funny from the like the whole consent story, 'cause from this perspective, I think when you know what it's like to be with a partner who is absolutely free to express their boundaries and their desires and their wishes, and you are too, and you know that they are into you and you are into them, and you know what the quality of that exchange, and I'm going to say the slowness, it doesn't have to be slow, but in my experience, that quality of exchange is more likely to be a slow, intimate, present exchange compared to the rumpy, bumpy, drunk sex that you were just describing, Emma. I think that once you've had that experience, there is no going back. You don't go back to drunken, slightly rapey, or full-on rapey sex once you've experienced the good quality. So
But a lot of people have never experienced the good quality, so they don't know the difference. So.
from this perspective, I go, oh God, in that sex you described, that is built around no one. No one is central in that. That is god awful. Plus, on some level, like I say, he's got to live with the guilt of that not being a perfect exchange. And on some level, you know. But yeah, until you've been drawn to it. So yeah, I go, God, no one wins from that exchange. But at the same time, I absolutely agree. And I'm so grateful that you articulated it around that very much looks like he can get away with it. It's built around his pleasure.
Well, I mean, and I guess I've had experiences where he clearly had a lot of fun and I really didn't. And a lot of that was not all, well, some of it was all his fault in some of the circumstances, not all, but a lot of it wasn't. A lot of it was communication breakdowns, etc. But there's a beautiful moment in an Australian film which sort of caught a tiny bit of it, and it, you know, again, it doesn't speak to the things I'm experienced with, but I think, you know, the three of us are in an extremely privileged position of being able to know quality sex. You know, that's amazing to be able to know that. But in this particular movie, the boyfriend and girlfriend, they're partners, they're consensual, they have had sex, and her comment is, "Oh my God, I've had pisses longer than that," and he's meanwhile had a great time. Now, knowing like great time, if he were a conscious, aware lover, he would go, "Ah, oh, that was maybe that wasn't satisfying or whatever." But there's a quick and dirty relief kind of experience, which can seemingly be far more satisfying for penis owners than for vagina owners. You know. Overall, it's not maybe satisfying for anyone in true sense, but in terms of just going, oh yeah, great, that was great, I knocked one off or whatnot. I'm making up horrible comments here, but like that sense of just, yes, I got my rocks off is seemingly far easier to achieve for a penis owner and seemingly just enough a lot of the time. If the choices of that or nothing, then sure, I'll go that.
I got a couple of thoughts. One is, I don't want to play tit for tat, but I too have had some frankly really fucking gross experiences with women that they thought were pretty good, and it may have included me ejaculating. But I'm spending a lot of time in management mode. I've copped a lot of like body shame and criticisms and stuff along the way, and fuck all of it's been around me. And sometimes it's including starfishing. So she's lying there expecting me to do all of the work. And then either accusing me of something or like selfish, for instance. It was like, well, fucking, yeah, get up and guide things where you want them. Or that was probably a bad example because it didn't match with one I was going with. I've certainly been in situations where I've just like managed myself and been on the fence of, oh Jesus, should I call quits on this or not? Or should I just like barge through? And my couple of rape experiences are situations where I've just done the maths and gone, it's easier for me to see this through than it is to pull out of it. It's going to have like too many complications for the relationship if I if I don't. So I don't want to play tit for tat, but I want to say, yep, I hear you. That happens everywhere. And my other thought, I think, is that a lot of the time when a situation like mine happens is, I think, because we go into it a lot with the expectations that he's probably shit and she's probably being used, it's really hard to spot when things don't actually match that pattern because we don't have so much awareness and articulation around it. So I don't know. I think all of us behave badly and well at various times, but we're more likely to spot when it looks like bad male behavior and her as victim. That said, I'm definitely not in a position to say where the tilt lies, and I don't even think I'd come at the question of who's got it worse and who's got it better.
No, I would suggest from that one of the fact that that was portrayed in a movie says that, think about the message that puts out there for men, is that even if it's fast for you, as long as you ejaculate, happy days. That's a shit thing to be conditioned to. Like, that's a really shit thing to be conditioned to. It doesn't really matter as long as you come. Doesn't matter if anyone else was happy or not in that process. Doesn't even matter if you were happy or not in that process. As long as you come, then you should be happy, and that's it. That's not a great position. That's really not fun. I just want to
It's
say.
very different to a message that says you have a right to pleasure and great sex, and here are some examples of what it might look like. Very different kind of role modeling.
Definitely.
Juicy conversation.
Now you're sad. Also, Roger, I'm sad that has been your experience. I've been there, but I'm sorry that you had that experience as well.
Thanks. I mean, I think it's fair to say we've all been there, right? I mean,
Easiest way is through rather than out. Yeah.
yeah, I'm sure pretty much every listener on some level relates. Okay, so what we're going to do now, dear listener, is using the very latest in immersive podcast technology, we're going to drop you into a real live experience of what it's like to be female in the dating game and the sex game, and what it's like to be male in the dating and the sex game. So, myself and my learned colleagues are going to talk you through the experience and frame it for you for the deepest possible immersion. Shut your eyes if that's what you need to do, dear listener, and have a little wriggle and a stretch so that the blah, 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 blah can take hold and kick in. Okay, so for the first round of this, you are female. You are in the dating game. Before you even log into the site, you get a bit of a sense of overwhelm, and you also get a bit of a sense of shame from the advertising about what your body looks like compared to the bodies that are on the front page. You realize how impossible it is to even do your profile. Because you're already trying to work out how you filter and how you create the language that filters out people that don't have the self-awareness to filter themselves out and are just going to come at you no matter what. So you try and work out whether it's like a soft touch or whether it's just a firm touch, and then the only ones that make it through are the rough and tumbles. You don't want to be sex shamed and found out by a neighbor or a workmate or a member of family who might then become a stalker. So you put up some photos and obscure your face and feel nervous about the whole operation. You feel slightly gross when you think about stories or your own experiences of dating. Turn your computer off and forget about it until a week later, when you think to log in and you've got 250 messages in which some of them are just outright horror stories. Some of them might be great. It's going to take you 2 days just to sift through them and get to the stage. And if you manage to make it through that filtering process, You start thinking through safe public places where you can meet. You start wandering through what connections and associations you might be able to make or check out. Is it rude to ask for ID? When you get to the dating stage, you find yourself being very careful about your alcohol consumption, managing expectations, keeping your eye on the exit, and I mean that physically as well as psychologically. So trying to gauge how invested this person is becoming in you, and what is going to be the path of least resistance to get out when you need to. If everything goes well and you find yourself in a sexual situation, it's hoping for the best, really hoping you've made the right judgment call around safety, tolerating and putting up with someone that doesn't really know how to touch you, but seems to want to be in charge. What else do we want to add to the female dating and sex experience?
Watching you drink. Guys, don't leave my drink unattended.
Wanting to flirt but not becoming too flirtatious.
Telling somewhere where you've gone.
Yep.
So how good is it, listener? Are you having fun yet? Okay, so if you really enjoy humiliation play, then you can pause the podcast here and stay with this experience for longer. But if you're ready to move on, then change gears, because now we're having an immersive experience in the male side of the dating game. In your case, you jump onto a website which we've preloaded with a whole bunch of people who really don't like you and don't trust you, and are not making any attempt to hide that fact. A bunch of people that talk about ways to approach them that are the complete opposite of the one before, but both of them talk with absolute confidence, like you should already know that, and why are you so stupid for not knowing that? You know that as you start making approaches, you're not going to get any approaches. There's almost no chance of that happening. So almost all of it's going to be 2 days of effort on your part to reach out and find people. You know that almost none of them are going to get replies. And even though you don't necessarily know that rejection fires up the same parts of the brain as actual physical pain, on some level you know it. The ones that reply, some of them might be interesting and good, some of them might be outright humiliation play that you didn't ask for. And you know that everything you do on that site can be used against you in a court of law. If you manage to get through that and get to a date, you know that everything you do there can be seen as creepy and dangerous and predatory. You know that some people will want you to ask questions about what you're meant to do, and some people will leave the moment you ask questions about what you're meant to do. Some people will expect you to know how to run their body without any instruction, even though it's completely different to the last one you played with. And what else do we need to add to this scenario?
Well, we certainly skipped the step that you'll be lucky if, several of the respondents aren't bots anyway.
Ah, yes.
Try and get your bank details.
Yes. You wonder why the dialogue seems to be going a bit flat, but without other options.
You wonder, you're encouraged to share, but not too much. And if you talk about your feelings too much or that kind of thing, then that's also not necessarily good. That's oversharing if you share your vulnerabilities.
Nice.
And if you don't do that enough, then you'll just be another asshole.
Nice. And don't it feel good? So again, if you're enjoying this play, pause the podcast and sit in it for a little longer. But otherwise, guys, suffice to say, the dating and the sex game, it just sucks for everyone. It's just so nasty. It's so entangled and dirty and Everyone loses from the exchange at the moment. I mean, it's not the whole story. We go on dating apps and sites because it works enough of the time and it's tolerable. And obviously, this whole immersion experience is like exaggerating things, but there's truth in it. There's some truth in that stuff. Like,
Oh, yeah.
you know, the male side of that's definitely rings some bells for me, and I'm guessing that the female side of that rings some bells for you.
Yep.
I am so sorry to everyone. It's such a messy situation.
Oh, what we forgot about all of them, that both the male side and the female side. If you're too old, well, you probably won't get many hits at all anyway. Or, if you don't look the way that somebody thinks you should look, or that society generally thinks is hot, then you probably get left on the shelf anyway, which is damn depressing.
In the background context of a world where, in some ways, where we make mumblings around not judging people by their bodies and being beyond that, the reality is we're not.
So not beyond that.
No.
That's a it is a mechanism geared for judging people by their looks. Like, absolutely. Nobody reads the words. You only read the words after the picture has passed.
True. All right, let's pull out of this depressing territory. I want to make a summary and then look to solutions. So in summary, I think that arguably men are behaving exactly as they should, given the inputs, given the operating environment. I think on balance, they've probably got less information and less options to practice, less freedom to explore, maybe, less support and less ability to ask for help. At the same time, they've got more criticism, more reputational risk, perhaps,
More lawsuit.
more lawsuits and more pressure to instigate and perform. And yeah, what we get back sort of exactly reflects that mess. So I think the solutions are, I actually think the reason I've labeled this episode so provocatively is that I think we need to stop talking like that. Because I think every time we say that the world is built around male sexuality, like with everything in this podcast series, it makes it almost impossible for us to spot, or it makes it harder for us to spot the ways that it is not stacked in their favour. And that makes it harder for us to plug those gaps. I think we need to stop bitching about how bad men are in bed. I think we need to start bitching instead about how underfunded resources are for male sex education. I think we need to find a better balance between identifying bad male behaviour and just wanting to rip the shit out of men for everything and anything. This is going to be super controversial. I think if you are female, it may be the case, and I stress may be, because there's more diversity amongst genders than there is between genders. So this won't be true for everyone. But if you're female, it's possible you need to step into your role and rank as the most educated one. So stand for what you know and share it, including the goodwill and the entitlement. And I mean that in the best possible way, the entitlement to pleasure and to knowledge and rights and choices about your body. Stand for it and share that. If you're in a heterosexual situation, show your partner what to do, and what to ask, and stop just hoping that he will eventually get it. Stop pretending that you are the one on the bottom of this ladder. Did
Can I
anyone spot
add?
the controversial bit?
Can I add? Stop assuming you know how to pleasure your partner and ask.
Yeah, nice.
Model
Nice.
the behavior.
Nice. Now, dear men folk, ask some questions. Read some books and information. It is out there. It is not impossible to come by. Learn. Admit that you have no idea what this is about, which is okay because you haven't been shown. There's no shame in that. Treat this, so this being sex and relationships and communication, etc., treat it as a hobby or an interest and get professional about that shit. Like, get on it. We talk like you're just meant to somehow magically have it, and that's crazy talk. Sorry about that. But yeah, you need to pick it up and get interested, get curious, get professional. And lastly, to funders, governments, charities, and sex educators, please stop providing your services exclusively around female pleasure.